Good afternoon, Greenbelt. How are you? Excellent.
I'm all right.
Thank you for asking. That's very kind. That's what I love about Greenbelt. So friendly. It's not one-way traffic. I would like to read you a quote I read on Gunga. Is it Gunga? Is that the right? Yeah. Gunga, yeah. That's an American accent. So Gunga, right. Okay, cool. On their blog recently, which I really liked. I think this is Michael writing. He says, "Don't let the politics and chaos fool you. The world still brims with glory. There's a beautiful moon in the sky right now, and at this moment your lungs keep inhaling and exhaling with unfathomable complexity and grace. Your heart and billions of other hearts keep beating. Every country around the world has people in it right now who are singing, laughing, dancing, making love, kissing their babies goodnight. The strings of our being keep vibrating, and that deep mystery of love that is all underneath it all keeps holding it all together. Yes, there's a lot to grieve lately. Violence, terror, climate change, racism. But there is also so much love, hope, and beauty surrounding us. Goodness that won't get reported on the news, but it is present in countless thoughts and interactions. Most of this beauty goes unnoticed by most people. I encourage you to take a moment to open your eyes and your heart and notice the glory brimming in the world around and within you now." I thought that was beautiful. Would you please welcome Gunga, Michael and Lisa. Welcome back to Greenbelt, guys.
Thank you so much.
Hey, hey,
so
hey.
Good to be here.
You just told me you flew over around about a week or so ago, and you've been...
Yeah, we did a little bit of Iceland vacation. We just finished our third record of the year, so we're just ready to not just be in some nature and enjoy ourselves. So we did Iceland, and then we went to the Netherlands, played a show, and now we're here.
Fantastic. Oh, clap for the Netherlands back.
Netherlands, yes.
Right there, too. Michael, that's a beautiful and quite profound quote. As I've been reading you, I confessed to you just now that a little while ago when I was afforded this joyous task, I wasn't familiar with your work. Forgive me for that.
Nothing to forgive. Thank you.
But I've kind of immersed myself in it, especially in the last few days. And I really like that quote because I sense that I do kind of, well, I sing. I write songs and I sing and I go around a bit like you guys. And one of the things that I try to do is to remind the people that we are not cynical and fearful people. And all that bad news and hype can make us that quite easily, even those who perhaps see the decency in it all. Would you like to unpack that a little bit more for us? What made you write that? What were the circumstances around it?
Probably, I mean, the news is always just dreadful. Because when we report on, you know, the news reports on the things that are the worst, most shocking things that are happening, and it's understandable. We need to know about it. We need to adjust and plan accordingly for the worst possible case scenario in case it happens or whatever. But you don't ever get reports on the mother that woke up again this morning and changed that diaper again and cleaned her house again and then really was nice to that neighbor as she, you know, like the normal stuff of life doesn't get reported, doesn't get sensationalized. And I know for me, in fact, right now I'm going through this where we were hacked and a bunch of our accounts were hacked and I've been going through all this. And so this interaction with this one hacker, it's making me like, the world is horrible. You know, like I feel from this one tiny subjective interaction, it's easy to like read broad, devastating things about the world. And so to kind of sometimes step back from your own circumstances and look at it and see a bigger picture rather than the thing that's like flaring up in your anger and in your stress and in your fear that speaks so loudly, to kind of take a step back from it all and just see it within a larger whole. And as a larger whole, it's all quite beautiful, the whole thing as a whole. So that was just a perspective thing, probably in the middle of all the stuff
I think
going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also, yep, you can applaud. Thank you. Thank you both. That was great. also, I think we live in unprecedented times in terms of, you know, we tend to think that it's the worst it's ever been or whatever, but you can look back through generations before us. They didn't have Twitter. They didn't have Facebook. They didn't have endless CNN, Fox, BBC news cycles that just keep throwing that negativity at you to the point where you become fearful. So I think that we forget that too. Can you, for those uninitiated in your music, I was listening at 1 a.m. to Vapor, which absolutely haunting and beautiful music. And it's more of those, fantastic. It's more, it's kind of hard to categorize your style. There are a myriad of influences, I feel anyway. It's very eclectic, very beautiful, profound in some ways too. Can I ask you musically influences? Where does it come from? Say before you pick up the guitar, or the keyboard, sing. What were you listening to? What that encouraged you in the first place to think I'd like to make music?
Well, I think that's we listen to a lot. I mean, we listen to lots of different genres. Probably the only genre we don't listen to is country music. Sorry, country people.
I'm kind of really bad. Well, some of it. No, I don't. So I some of it. I don't like the twangy. Horse is not well, and I really need to do something about that horse. And
that's sad.
If she would only love me, my horse would get better.
We're influenced by so much. I mean, when I was young, I was only really allowed to listen to Christian music, and then I would sneak into my sister's room and listen to all the bad stuff at nighttime. So we're influenced by all these things, but one of the main people for me, I love Jansi, I love Sigur Rós. It was really awesome to be in Iceland and feel the the space and the landscape that influenced their music, and Björk, and but we're influenced by so many, it's really hard to pinpoint exactly one thing. And so I think you can hear pieces as we've evolved. You definitely can hear more of what, like, we've been listening to and come out in what we've been writing. But I kind of feel like these last three albums that we're doing, the One Wildlife trilogy, has been more so our own thing than ever before. We were just talking about that. Do you feel that way? I think it's I think we've definitely evolved over the years, and we always kind of made music like that is its own experiment. Like, we'll start this song, and then what if we threw in this? What would this sound like? And what it would happen if we, like, slammed a drawer of utensils and, you know, made a beat out of that? And so it's always been kind of like this, hey, what would the rustling of this, like, these things sound like within the song? And tried to use just things that were around. It's always been really fun.
Organic.
Yeah.
Okay, can you... So I Am Mountain came out in 2013. You are now embarking on this sort of adventure of three albums together that kind of are individual, but they're a whole as well, right? Could you elaborate a little on that for us?
Yeah, so we moved to Los Angeles like about almost a year and a half ago, and moving there, we had a little baby girl, who's how many months now?
Wait, are you? You're the father? she's two.
I know. I said months. I know she's
okay.
Two.
Okay.
We don't have to go by months anymore.
Oh,
I don't know
months.
How many months old I am.
How many months old are you?
I can go with years. That's fine too. Yeah, that's fine.
So she's what? She's like.
But I
30
I was dealing
months.
With like a year and a there half of time zone. I didn't know how long she had been alive when we moved there. But anyway, we had recognized that having Lucy as a second child made traveling a lot more difficult, and made touring a lot more difficult. So we wanted to like be a little bit more planted in our world. Lucy has Down syndrome and needs like. physical therapies, all these therapies all the time and stuff. So so traveling is more difficult than it was before. So we're like, we've gone through a lot over the last few years. We've got a lot that we're writing. We've got a lot of material. What if we, like, rather than just one record, we tried a trilogy? So we tried it, and we did it. And we're about to release the third one here in a little bit. And it's just an exploration of what is it to be a human being, and what is it to see? What are we here for? And we started our careers kind of started within church music world, and everybody was always wanting us and ourselves. We tended to write about things about God and existential things and questions and doubts as that evolved. But we wanted to write about more than that, and this was kind of a way of an avenue to write about all the stuff we were also wanting to write about. So this One Wild Life kind of allowed us to talk about some of those still existential things, but also other things like our baby girl and the stuff we went through that, and the pain of change of beliefs and all the stuff that we had been experiencing. This kind of was a nice way of writing about it all and expressing it musically.
Yeah.
And a theme that kind of just goes throughout the three albums. We had moved to Los Angeles, and we both kind of felt like, especially for me personally, I was experiencing a lot of depression, just deep depression for the first time in my life. And I really didn't know what to do with that. Here we had this two beautiful girls. Our second daughter had to have some surgeries. And so there was a chain of events that was like happening in our life. I'm sure some of you out there have experienced this times in your life where you just feel like, man, it's just not lighting up. Just thing after thing after thing. And then you feel like you're getting a breath, and then something else hits that just knocks the wind out of you. And then I was just constantly terrified that our youngest daughter, something else was going to come up, and that I was just always terrified for her health, for her future. And so I just found myself in this place of, and it sounds really dramatic, but I just found myself in this place of like, life is just not going to be good again. And then this whole social media thing, like blew up with us, and we thought our career was over. And so I just thought, well, this is it. I'm going to go kind of crazy, and I'm going to be a naked woman in the mountains, and that's how my life's going to end. But that's a great way to end your life, I'm sure. Just wild, naked in the mountains, right? I don't know.
Is there reference to that on the album at all?
Yes. Yeah. maybe in one of our new videos, maybe.
That'll get the hits.
It's not me. I'm not naked. But so it came out of this thing of like, whoa, okay, like people have been through these crazy traumatic experiences. And what is the difference between the people who let that crush them and and other people who actually make it into something else, and they see this other side of life and they are better for it? And I had this realization one day of, whoa, it is my decision. This is my decision. It's life happens to you, and it's your decision what you see. I don't know if any of you have seen that movie, The Life of Pi. So what is it? Is it all these animals? What is it? Is that the point of it? And so it was like one. I mean, and I feel like I've had a few of these different moments, like these profound experiences of like, the sun shines through the clouds and you're like reborn again, and I'm just like walking down the street, pumping my fist like, yeah, I am alive, and just feeling so like cheesy and silly. And but feeling that like within the very heart of me, this rebirth of, this is my decision. What am I going to see? And I choose to see light. And so throughout the whole album, we talk a lot about that, of sight, and what are you choosing to see? Are you feeling all of it? There's something within the pain and suffering and joy and goodness of life. When we separate all of it and try to only feel the good vibes and push away the painful vibes, you're missing out on a huge piece of what it is to be a human being. And to feel. And so we talk about, yeah, we talk about a lot of that throughout the three of them, feeling it all, being the whole human experience, seeing clearly, ripping away these lenses that we tend to see all of life through, and to try, not that we do see like reality and for exactly what it is, but yeah, this practice of sight and seeing what's before us, like for me, the perfect, like the answer for my ask with
without
like,
judgment.
Yeah, without judgment. Yeah. So,
and that sense of honesty too, because I think what people need more than anything right now is integrity and honesty, so that we're not saying this is what it is when it's not.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're trying to address that, which is brave. Good for you. In that context, I'm pushing it a little bit further now. The Greenbelt Festival has been here for, gosh, how many years is this now? How many? 42 years.
Wow.
42 years of the festival. 43. Sorry, they're
That's
arguing.
Amazing.
All right. So, what are you doing? Give me positive information. Go to the back. It's a faith-based festival, but you don't have to carry the God card to show up here. Mm-hmm. Much of the, you know, some of the music, often Greenbelt gets into trouble for experimenting that way, but it has a vision that that it's not just those with faith that actually speak into the kingdom, as it were. You know, so therefore, a lot of mainstream artists have come here, loved it, come back again, mm-hmm. because they saw an openness here, are welcoming that perhaps other... If they were, you know, they would shy away from the word Christian festival or whatever it might be. Now, when I went to listen to some of your music on SoundCloud, there was the category Christian in the corner. And when you, I know you've been nominated for Grammys, but in the gospel part of it, does that bother you?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, very much so. I've tried to, like, recently in this last year come back to terms with like it's okay, like any genre applied to anything is a reduction of it on some level if it's a good thing, you know, if it's made well. Any genre, any, my favorite films kind of transcend genre usually, you know, my favorite music transcends genre. So like some of it's just an ego thing, like don't, I just hate Christian music so much that I don't want to be associated with. I mean, there's a lot of people in Christian music that I love. Don't get me wrong. A lot of people, my brother has a band called The Brilliance, and they're technically Christian music, even though, you know. So not saying all Christian music is bad. I just, as a whole, the thing seems really soulless and disturbing to me in a lot of ways. But so like making music that some people have labeled as that. And we went through a lot trying to not be, like, we spent a lot of money and a lot of effort trying to not be labeled as Christian music. And it didn't work because we just sang too much about God in our early, and you know, you hear, and I'm coming back to being like, I don't care, call it what you want. We're making music. So I'm less offended by it than I was a year or two ago, for sure. But it's a marketing thing, because it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't. The people that make Christian music aren't necessarily Christians, and the people that Christians make music that's not labeled as Christian music, it doesn't mean anything. It's a marketing gimmick that usually targets a specific demographic, and that demographic usually doesn't like Gungor, which is weird. But we're always been kind of on the fringes of, like, well, we sing a lot about God, and people that are, everybody, you know, most people in the music industry know, like, even Christians know, like, if you sing too much about God, you get relegated to this weird ghetto thing that is Christian music. So a lot of Christians, like, kind of have navigated those lines. Don't play too many churches. Don't play, you know, you'll get sucked in. And we started in the belly of the beast. So, you know, at this point, I think we just are trying to make, and what we've always been doing on level is make stuff that is meaningful to us. And for me as a writer personally, I've always just, the way my mind, what I'm thinking about most of the day is not about, you know, I've been married. We got married. I was married at 19 years old. So I'm not like, baby, why did you leave me? I'm not thinking about heartbreak songs with a girl. It's Lisa and I, you know, like, fine. I'm not thinking about, what I'm thinking about is like, why am I here? What is all of this? We're on a rock spinning around a star, and that's insane. And what does anything mean? Does anything mean anything? And is love a real thing that I can... You know, that's what I think about all the time. So that's what I write about.
Can I push it a bit further then?
Yeah.
And I do this... I think it's a... You come from a different culture to the British culture.
Yeah.
Certainly in terms of
yeah.
religion, Christianity, what that means over there as such. We kind of came to the conclusion, I think, well, at least, I know I have, I can't speak, but I got fed up of hearing people saying, God gave me this song, and then when you hear the song, you know why God wanted to get rid of it, that type of thing. So,
yeah, totally.
I don't applaud that. That's cheap.
That's good.
It's cheap. It's cheap.
That's clever
you can applaud
it's
that.
Fine.
It's fine.
Yeah,
but my question is, does Christian music actually exist?
No, it's a marketing thing. There's nothing...
So there's no such thing as Christian music.
No.
Did I write a blog thing that
No, time? You didn't.
Okay.
I'm right. This is one of my blogs, probably.
This is a blog he's writing.
What I'm saying is music is the creator of music. That's a tree. It's not a Christian tree.
Exactly.
Yeah. We often
it's
say, like, well,
there's
like
good
your pants.
And there's
are
bad.
Are your pants Christian pants? You know?
Yeah.
I hope so.
Not right now. So in that sense, it's just nonsense, right?
Yeah. It is nonsense.
Yeah.
It is nonsense. And yet it's a mega industry over there.
Yeah, within a certain demographic of people that doesn't like Gunga.
Yes. I thought we'd spend longer on that question, but we haven't. It was just gone. That was it. It was just, no, it's not. That's great. Okay. We'll move on. But no,
they liked our song "Beautiful Things," though. That crowd, they liked it. They do, yeah. They
who's,
liked that.
Who's
and
they?
I think that's what the group that the Christian music like
oh
center
yeah.
the Beast, you know.
The Beast.
They liked that song because it, and they thought you know you make things out of the dust, and they thought we were like literal creationists saying 6,000 years ago, the dust, and so that's what our social media a few years ago they're like. You were lying? I was like, it's a song. It's like it's a metaphor.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean. Being there, my brother. I've been there. I know what you mean. Tell me something about the Liturgists, which is another collaboration thing that you have going on.
Yeah, so after, I mean, it's a funny thing to have been writing music through my whole process of like, I mean, since fundamentalist evangelical American Christianity, worship leader, mega church on the path to, you know, to the cover
check.
Of Christianity Today.
Yes.
maybe, you know, maybe the earth is a little older than 6,000 years and maybe, you know, like, gay people aren't the worst thing in the world. And maybe, you know, starting to think thoughts, oh no. And then people are like, what are you singing about? And then into full out, like, not believing anything. During the process between Ghosts Upon the Earth and I Am Mountain, went to a full, like, I don't believe anything anymore. And then there was some beginnings of reconstruction that started happening right before we finished Iron Mountain. So there is some reconstruction on Iron Mountain. And then after that, so it's weird to have gone through all that kind of publicly. And now I'm tired and jet-lagged and I forgot why I started saying this.
About the liturgists.
The liturgists.
You can just liturgist. Keep talking about, you know.
I met Science Mike in that process. this guy, Science Mike, who's this super nerd, down to his core. He's the nerdiest guy you'll ever meet, but he's brilliant. And I met him after this deconstruction, kind of before I am out in this deconstruction time. and was telling him, like, I don't believe in anything at this point. But I was starting to read some other kind of stuff. Like, I was reading some Karen Armstrong and some different kind of like ideas about, Eastern, you know, Orthodox ideas of God, which is like not ideas, you know, apophaticism is sort of deconstructing the idea of ideas of God. And so I was kind of, and Peter Rollins and different people, I was reading stuff that was like starting to, after a nice honeymoon of like not having to think about any of that for a while, because I grew up with it and that's all I ever thought about. And then I had a moment like, oh, I don't have to think about what is all this. Just, it's nothing. It's chaos, meaninglessness, nice. But then kind of coming back to, and I met Mike and we started these conversations, and he had been a Baptist, Southern Baptist, which is like super conservative American Christian, became an atheist, and then had this crazy mystical experience where God spoke to him, and he didn't believe in God, so he thought he had a brain, something happened to him. And then we started this, and he created these axioms about like God is at least the natural forces that created and sustained the universe as experienced via the evolved neurologic social neurologic features in humans. And even if that's all that God is, this pursuit of that subjective experience has been shown with studies to promote peace and empathy and well-being. So the pursuit is warranted. I was like, interesting. And so we started all these conversations, and we started like this thing called the liturgists, and we make spiritual work liturgy for people that might be a little bit like we felt, a little spiritually homeless or frustrated, that are interested in spiritual conversation, interested in spiritual things, but maybe a little weary of how religion has organized and the authoritarian stuff that happens. And so we just had these, and then a podcast started, and we just have conversations about all of that and try to help create work and space for people that feel spiritually homeless and frustrated.
So it's kind of two things, which there are some like online meditations, just for anyone who might be a little confused by that. There's like online meditations that are like these guided meditations, and there's like artwork and songs and stuff that go with it. And then there's the podcast that Michael and Science Mike do together that's been going very, very well. It's been really cool.
Yeah, it seemed like such a niche thing. Like, who's gonna care about this? And we're just seeing people all over the world. It's been amazing to see all the people that are both deconstructed Christians, post-Christian, never, you know, just atheists, but also people right in the middle of Southern Baptist churches that are like closeted, you know, questioners or whatever. And like, I can't talk about this or I will lose my job. Or my family will disown me if I say these things, but thank you for having these conversations. And it's happening all over the place. And so just, all the stuff that we went through as far as the CCM audience getting mad at us and sort of disowning us, and all the pain of that has been really, I'm actually really grateful for at this point, because it's opened up these pathways to more true conversations and honest relationship with where we're at, and it's created a lot of safe space for a lot of people.
Cool. Sounds fantastic. Let me talk to you about something. This is a bit of a spanner in the works. It's something that I've been wondering about lately. The crowdfunding aspect of what you've just done to make these new albums. I sometimes have a problem with this. Not totally, in terms of... I know a lot of people, artists, who are doing it. But I just... I'm not totally at, I don't know, for want of a better word, at peace with it. Because you blogged about the music industry machine. And there was a friend of yours who felt that he was getting so caught up in promoting records, going out and having to do the video and all that stuff, that this was actually taken away from the creative process. And that's what you saw, that vision, mm-hmm. that he wanted, and yourself, that you wanted to to concentrate on that. And a lot of artists do this now. And I know some friends of mine who raise incredible amounts of money. And then they make a record because they've got that amount of money that really spoils their art in the process because they overindulge. Mm. And out comes this record with strings and, you know, five drummers and everything on it. And it's and then they go out and do their acoustic show.
Yeah. Yeah.
And someone buys the record and they're trying to be something that really they're not. Mm. But they've got all that money, et cetera, et cetera. But also, I just wonder, you know, are we overstating, and I say this with total due respect, I'm just interested in the debate. Are we overstating our worth? For instance, a father might say, you know what, I feel like me having to go to work, this is a stupid example, but, you know, that's actually taken away from my true calling to be a father to my child. So I wonder if I might crowd surf so people say that I don't have to go out there and do all the dirty work so I can actually stay at home with my baby for a year, you know?
Mm, yeah.
Why do we as artists feel that we have something, a slightly different calling to those that we want? To raise money. If that offends you, I'm sorry. I'm just interested in your thoughts on that process because I'm not saying it's wrong either. I just wrestle with it a little bit in my head. You know,
I think it's a valid question. I don't know those people. I don't know that I've heard those stories of like raising so much money, but anyone that I've known that has tried to do that has raised just the minimum, if not enough, to make an album.
Sure.
And music has changed in such a drastic way that people aren't buying it. So I personally feel like it was the answer for people who just couldn't do it anymore. But I mean, we're making 3 albums and most people are getting it for free and we're working our ass off. So, and with the liturgist, even this liturgist thing, I mean, there's a podcast, it's free, free, free. And I think there's so much art that is free and that people, the consumer, have this idea that they deserve it. And we want people to have it and have this wonderful experience and this, we would keep doing that no matter what. But it comes to a point for a lot of people that they actually can't because they're not making, music is not selling like it used to. I mean, I don't know how it is, I guess, here in the States, nobody buys records. Even music people, it's all streaming, and even, I mean, with Spotify and Apple Music, you hardly get paid anything, and there are so many great bands that just can't survive anymore. So what they're doing with these sorts of things is it's how they pay for their music. And then all those people that supported that and donated, they get whatever they're making for free because they paid for it from the top end.
I mean, I think it's not an unprecedented thing. First of all artists, usually, even if historically, there's either an element of there were patrons that hired them to do a piece of work. There was work that was, paint the Sistine Chapel for us. Here's some money to do it, you know. Or musicians on the street asking for money. The thing about art is it's not necessarily commercially inherently feasible. It's not necessarily like an obvious, it doesn't provide, you know, it's not like you need that, you know, that loaf of bread to survive. So you pay me, here you go. It's sort of this ethereal, do you like me making the music? Would you like me to keep making the music and not have to go work at the bread company? There's that. The musicians have always had to deal with that. So I personally am not a person who likes to ask for help. My pride doesn't like that at all.
Is there a danger, too, that it would take you, because if you're staying at home making a record, but those people that love the connection with you in a venue,
sure.
Is there a danger that they're going to, you won't tour so much because you'll lose out?
For sure. And I think that, what I like about where the culture is at with art creation is with technology and streaming and everything, it's made an opportunity for everybody to create more art. And now anybody can make a record. If you have a phone in your pocket, you could make a record. You know what I mean? If you have a computer and a little mic, you can make a record and you can make it sound pretty good. You can get some plugins. You can make it decently. Whereas in, 20 years ago, to have and when you make your phone on record, you get the same distribution as Beyonce has. You can put it on iTunes or on Apple Music and Spotify. That's the same place. That's the same place that people go to listen to Beyonce. You can go listen to Beyonce or listen to the dude who recorded a phone record. And it's all right there. Where 20 years ago or whatever, you'd have to make it into these small group of labels that will allow you to have enough budget to record at any recording studio that costs a ridiculous amount of money. And then the only way people can hear about it is if it's distributed through a store, a physical store, which they only have deals with a certain amount of distribution people. So you have to know these people, these specific, you know, it's just a much, much smaller world, which probably there's ups, there's goods and bads of that. For sure. But I think everybody in the music industry is just trying to adapt and figure out how can we make music. And if we can do it for a living and not have to spend our days working at the bread factory or whatever. I mean, there are musicians that I know that I listen to that I certainly want them spending their day on music and not making coffee or whatever. Just for the sake of everybody, for the sake of the world. So the people that are stepping up, the people that are still, the few people that are still buying records, giving to crowdfunding stuff. And our record wasn't actually a crowdfunding thing. We did a season pass thing, actually, which is a little different thing where we, people kind of at the beginning bought all three. And so they got the first one with some bonus content. And then throughout it, we've given them bonus little things. And we'll give them more bonus stuff at the end. But they get the record before everybody. And so it's been a little kind of a hybrid. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't necessarily think that there should be one path, not just for musicians, but for any creative or any human being anyway. I think we're all just trying to figure out how to get by, how to be okay, and the things that we value, we pay for it. That's how it works. So everybody's just trying to figure it out.
Cool. Thank you for entering into that debate. Yeah. I appreciate it. I've got two more questions, and then we'll open it up to finish off with some folks from the floor here. Michael, you talk about finally letting go of trying to believe anything at the end of 2012. Once you did that, you were able to engage in mystery in a different way. Again, forgive me for relating to myself personally, but many of us at Greenbelt have been on that same journey as you. For me, it was sitting with powerless people that made me realize I couldn't go back and sing those answer songs. That every song I would write really from that moment on in 88 was going to be a question. For me, that changed my music into a socially driven style. In other words, in terms of I wanted to sing about issues. That's where that imploded itself. And I don't like the protest singer, but that sort of vein. How did it affect your art, that return to the mystery, shall we say?
Because we've always tried to write from a soulish place, meaning like at the core of, you know, when I listen to a song, I mean, there's nothing, not just with our own music, but any song, there's songs, there's music that I experience, there's art that I experience that opens up my heart and my soul in a way that nothing else can. Well, that's not necessarily true, because when you experience that enough and you learn how to move into that place of being fully present in the here and now, seeing the glory that we're talking about of a beautiful piece of music, or I think what it can train you to do over time is to hear the beauty in a single note. And the beauty of a sunrise can help train you to see the beauty of a dead piece of grass, you know? So once again, my jet lag, where was I going? I'm sorry. I really am exhausted. So the deconstruction. So it everything that we were experiencing and have experienced, because we've tried to make music from that place, has always impacted the music. And it's hard. It's so hard to see the direct ties for me. like, why when I believed in the rapture did I write more strummy acoustic guitar stuff with, you know what I mean? Like, how did the music of my, that was associated with where my soul was, where I was looking for like this escape. It's an interesting question, and you could really go deep with it, I'm sure. But I think that I think all of our aesthetic assumption, the reason that we're in a tent with these little flags and every aesthetic decision that you see around us, the clothes that we're all wearing, it's all coming from somewhere. It's all coming from some sort of deep assumptions about reality and of the universe and of ourselves. And to be aware of those things and to dig into why, I think, is certainly an interesting endeavor. I think most of us are pretty blind, including myself, to why, as my beliefs change, does my approach to art change? All I know is it certainly does, as you've looked over historically through my life and what I believed and how the music was influenced and what I'm creating now based on where I'm at. I know that they're tied together. I know that my assumptions about reality and God totally have everything. There's something to do with why when I pick up my guitar, I prefer this shape of chord right now than that shape of chord. But that's a really... I mean, that's a hard thing to probe. That's a deep well to probe, and I don't know if we could ever like really fully know that. But I do see a tie for sure.
Sure. My last question, still kind of slightly on that subject, but maybe Lisa wants to tackle this. Bruce Springsteen, who's an elder in my church, he talks about his work measuring the distance between the American dream and the American reality. That's what he measures. What do you think your music measures?
Quite a question.
You don't know, that's fine.
I feel pressure for it to be a really good answer.
Yeah.
I guess on some level it for me measures the distance between my heart and my fingers, how can I put what's in my heart into note and word and timbre. And for me, that's a big drive. Like, that's what I'm driving at when I'm going back. Like, what is this song's not quite it? Why? Because it's not the thing that I'm feeling in my heart that's supposed to exist out in the world, out here in the manifest world. So getting it from the heart to the fingers, when I'm actually vibrating the strings and pushing the chord and putting it into my vocal cords and putting it into, that's the distance that's difficult for me.
I feel like I know now. I had to think about it. I think for me it is vulnerability. We were just talking about this yesterday, and I'm reading this book right now. She's talking a lot about, she's like this vulnerability expert, sure, Brené Brown. Yeah, I'm like, Brené Brown. She and she talks about it in a way that I just have never thought about it before. And for us, we've always been really wanted to just be really open. Like when that whole thing kind of came out about like, oh, you guys were lying to us, it hurt a lot deeper than I thought it would, because from a very, and I'm not saying this as like a proud thing, but from very early on, we saw people, friends, fellow musicians in that world taking, like, they had this split kind of life happening, to where there was this life, this was who they really were, and they would cuss and drink and do all these like bad Christian things, you know, or cool Christian things, I don't know. whatever you want to call it. And then there was this shiny, bright life where, you know, they had to be someone else and they couldn't say certain things and they couldn't post photos on Instagram of them drinking wine and because they knew they'd lose people. So they began living this double life. And that goes deep. When you start living that kind of life, it's not just a surface thing. It goes deep into your soul. And anyone that I know that was doing that or is still just in a really, it's sad. It's a bad place. It's a real dark, soulless place. And so we saw this happening. And honestly, there's been moments we've wanted to do that. And because you see, you get paid more. But we decided early on not to do that and have always really tried hard not to do that and maybe not have always done it perfectly. But I think for me, when I'm writing a song, if it's not vulnerable, I don't really like it. It doesn't matter if it's a sad song or a happy song or whatever, but if it doesn't come from the deepest part of me that is somehow opening up my own heart to hopefully open up someone else's heart and their own level of vulnerability and sometimes I think, I mean, I don't know, we were talking about this last night at dinner. We're such people that we just want people to really know. We don't want to trick someone. And it's really important to us. I think that has a lot to do with just, if any of you are familiar with like the Enneagram and just our personality traits. You know, if we think that someone's being a little two-faced, that's a real big issue. And so sometimes we're a little too much and too open, maybe, you know, like, and I'll say like, oh my God, I got in this conversation and I just found myself saying things and I'm going, stop talking. Don't tell them that. But I do. And I should probably stop. But that's important to me. This vulnerability, this shared, like, I want to know that I'm really talking to you and not some mask. And I realize that there are layers and there are certain, as old Brené Brown says, you know, that there's certain conversations that should happen in different spaces. But for the art that we make, I think we always just really try to be vulnerable.
I think, and you, as you do that, you make your listener feel like they're not alone in the world.
They're not alone, yeah.
That's the job of a good song,
right? Yeah. I think that's the best thing that someone could say. It was like, you said this, and I thought, me too.
I'm not alone. Great. Yeah. Wonderful, thanks. We've got 5 minutes. Anyone would like to come to the microphone and ask these beautiful people a question? Please do so now. And quickly. Oh, people are leaving. No, I want that.
They're out.
Yeah, on that, sir. Yeah, thank you.
Hi. One of the earlier words you talked about was about one of the energies in Christian music being authoritarian. Mm. But you also talk about vulnerability being something that people are drawn to. Mm. And I'm wondering, what is it about humanity and human spirit in general that draws it both towards authoritarian control and also towards vulnerability and openness? Is that the same energy or is it different?
Mm. Mm.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question. I think on some level, we're all just trying, not on some level, at the deepest level, we're all just trying to be okay, right? I mean, every action that anybody ever takes starts from a place that has, you could call, a good intention, if you will. There's like, even horrible acts that end up destroying other lives, they're usually, it's starting at a place of wanting to be okay, wanting to experience even a sadistic joy. You know, and that's it turns and gets gross and needs to be adjusted. But so I think there's a common, all human action, there's a root, I think, that it starts from. And so the desire, it is weird to see how the desire for authority and the desire for vulnerability or even subservience to authority, even, you know, like, it's strange how in America right now with the Trump people, that it's like, we're sick of this authoritarian government telling us what to do, so let's have this horrible demagogue authoritarian person rule everyone. You know, it's like this weird irony. And so I think that exists within religion, within just within the human experience. We have these strange paradoxes within ourselves. You know, the most adamant, a lot of times the people that are most against LGBTQ people have some sort of like secret closeted LGBTQ, you know, leaning or something. Like people that are trying to shut it down. They're trying to shut it down. The people that are most mad about when Rob Bell writes a book about hell, the people like, they know, you know, they know that their beliefs on hell are ridiculous. So they don't want to know it. They don't want to know. They shut it down. So the authoritarian thing and the vulnerability, it gets weird. What is it to be a human being and have all these conflicting, strange emotions that we act out? But that's a really interesting observation, how those work.
Yeah, that's a great question. One more. Yeah, go.
Thank you. I was interested to hear when you talked about your entry out of the void into the mystery of it all, and you talked about your engagement with tradition and Eastern Orthodoxy and that kind of stuff. And I think you get a bit of foreshadowing of that from your earlier stuff and thinking mm-hmm. about the prayer of St. Augustine from the Confessions that you used. Augustine, who engaged so much about doubt and in yourself and in God and all that kind of thing. And I wondered how tradition still kind of feeds into what you're doing, whether there's anyone particular you've drawn upon.
Thank you.
I mean, that's definitely been a difficult thing for us, difficult waters, because as we've tried to reincorporate some of these traditions, it's hard. It's hard to, once our language has been formed, it's hard to say some of these words or do some of these traditions again and not have like kind of a gross feeling attached to it after you've gone through some of it. But I think something that's recently been really helping us is we've been listening to Ram Dass, and he speaks about Buddha and he speaks about Jesus, and it kind of is like it enlivens scripture again, and it enlivens these traditions in a way that I just wasn't expecting. And I you kind of go, oh, like I get it, the old wineskins kind of thing, and the new wine, you know, like something could be said or done the same way, but it all of a sudden means something different. I think one thing that for me has always been still beautiful, a tradition that we've held on to, is Eucharist. But even as I do it, I feel like it's weird. You know, I'm like, this is weird. The blood and the body. I mean, that seems, if I went on to like a, if I found some tribe out and as it went on the naked lady in the mountains, you know.
And you find your tribe. Earlier,
I find my tribe, yeah. If I was stumbling upon these people and they were doing this thing, I'd be like, that is super sick. Like, that's real gross, guys. But it's the point of it, right? The opening of the heart, my life is bigger than my own, and what has love done? And I mean, it's all of this. It's bigger than just this bread and this wine and da, 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 da. So that's something that I've come back to. I think we threw away a lot of the traditions and have come back to a few of it. You can speak to that.
And just real quick, where I'm at now, more than ever in my life, I'm actually valuing every stage of the journey that so far and see it as part of the same path. And so there was never, at this point, the way I see things, there was never leaving God to move to atheism, leaving atheism to move to mysticism. It was all within God, what I would call God. It was all within the reality that is, at this point, I don't think there's anything to believe in or not believe in. It's just what is. And you use your metaphors, use your traditions, use it, and it's all, we're all moving through the path. Mm-hmm. And certain traditions have meant more to me at certain times, and I have traditions that mean a lot to me more right now than they used to, and they might not as much a year from now, I don't know, 5 years from now. But I'm trusting the path more, and I think you find that within really all the great religions. You find kind of at a point of the path, all of them, they all start sounding really alike. Mm-hmm. Like Jesus says a lot of the same stuff that Buddha said. There's a lot of the things that you can look at the sayings. Like there's a lot of the same. You said, you know, like the Dalai Lama sounds a lot like some Catholic mystic Well, that's a lot like Richard Rohr. You know, like at a certain point of the journey, it all kind of starts like you're moving into the light. And so I am, we grew up with Christian tradition and still the Christian stories, the Christian traditions like the Eucharist, it's still, if I hear something about a saying of Jesus and he says you have to be like a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven, and there's a new thing that kind of flips on in my brain right now about what that might mean, I don't know if it's sentimentality, but I'm like, oh, I love it. I'm loving Jesus again in ways that I haven't in a long time. So my Christian tradition, but the Christian stories, the Christian metaphors, I'm finding a lot of beauty in. But I find them elsewhere. But you know, stories about Hanuman in the serving Ram in the Hindu tradition, I can like see the story and think that's nice, but it doesn't get me in the same way as if I have a new like glimpse of how a metaphor about the Garden of Eden was it's part of my childhood, it's part of my tradition, it's part of what's my psyche.
Not at all. I want to thank Michael and Lisa so much for being back at Greenbelt for a second time. We want to thank you for your integrity, your honesty. You're obviously doing something very unique and special, especially over in the States, which we love you for. And go see these guys on the Glade stage at 6 o'clock tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Gungor, the band that will not lie to you.